Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Le notti di Cabiria. 188A, quarta. Silenzio! Azione!
Adornazzari, ma io c'ho casa mia, sa, con l'acqua, la luce, il pibigas, non mi manca niente, proprio tutte le comodità, c'ho perfino il termometro. Questa qui, sotto l'archi, non ci ha mai dormito. Ma una volta, o due.
Ragazzi, mi si smonta tutto. Più. Due giorni qua non ci deve essere più niente. Bisogna cominciare subito. Coraggio, al lavoro, buttate giù. Dico bene, dottore?
Sì, grazie. Arrivederci, ragazzi. Ci vediamo in un prossimo film.
Lo speriamo.
Ciao, mattinari.
Welcome to Cinema Italia, a podcast dedicated to the world of Italian cinema. Presented by me, John Bleasdale.
Everybody and welcome to Cinema Italia. My name's John Bleasdale. I'm a writer and film critic, and I'm joined today by David Rooney, the chief film critic of Hollywood Reporter. And today we're going to be talking about Knights of Cabiria, Federico Fellini's masterpiece. I mean, it's difficult, actually, David. I say Federico Fellini's masterpiece, but I mean, there are so many that it's almost as if Federico Fellini's masterpiece is just like saying a Fellini film.
Well, yeah, I would agree, but there is definitely some I like a lot more than others, and Cabiria is absolutely my favorite. You know, every time we wrestle every 10 years with what to put in that Sight and Sound poll of the best films of the world, things come and go for me, but Cabiria is always there. I adore that film, and I have to say, yeah, probably I'm in the minority of liking the early Fellini, where he still had one foot very firmly in neorealism, to the later Fellini, when he kind of discovered his showmanship and his extravaganza, sort of phantasmagoria kind of Fellini-esque personality really emerged. But I like seeing the roots of it in the early films as well. So I would say my favorites are probably Vitelloni, La Strada, and Cabiria, which are all from the early period, the pre-Dolce Vita Fellini.
Yeah, I mean, Lo Cieco Bianco, the White Sheik, as well, as one that I would maybe add to that list as a
fantastic. And Alberto Sordi, you know, an actor who kind of too often was just relegated to playing shticky comedy. It's just so great in that.
Do you remember when you first saw this film?
I came to it in a roundabout kind of way, a very gay boy kind of way. I came to it via Sweet Charity.
Shirley MacLaine's musical comedy version.
Yes, I didn't see it, Sweet Charity, on the stage until much later. So this was the Bob Fosse film version, which he famously had trouble with. You know, he tangled with the studios. He was not happy with the way it came out. I get the feeling, even though I think it was never public, that he and Shirley MacLaine did not get on. And he really tussled about the ending. He wanted the ending to be true to the stage show, which is actually true to the film, to Cabiria, very downbeat, but very with this element of hope to it. And the studios, he just anticipated that they would want a happy ending. So he shot a happy ending that he was not happy with. And to his great surprise, the studio said, no, you're right. The sad ending is better. So he did get the ending he wanted, but I think he was not happy with the film. And all of that experience, I think, taught him to be tougher and to demand stronger terms when he then went back to do Cabaret and really did sort of find his mojo as Bob Fosse on screen. But so I saw Sweet Charity. I loved the story and I was curious about it. And I think I just went through a sort of a binge period of finding all these Fellini screenings at little repertory houses in Sydney, Australia. And Cabiria was one that just blew me away. It was so emotional. First of all, so funny. The film is hilarious.
Absolutely.
And then it just takes this turn and the pathos is enormous. And of course, there's, you know, there's wild melodrama there, but it's always deadly, deadly serious. And I think so few filmmakers have been able to capture that balance. You know, for me, one of them is Almodovar, who can be absolutely hilarious and have this extreme pathos that rips your heart out at the same time. And I think that Fellini really kind of struck that note, both in Cabiria and in other films like La Strada. You know, I think the combo of Fellini and Giulietta Masina, his wife and his muse in so many films, was just unbeatable. And this film in particular, I have to say, I love the combination, you know, the spectacle and squalor, the sacred and the profane, the dreams and the magic, and then the sort of purity and innocence of that naive earlier time, the cruelty of reality, all these things that come together so beautifully in it. So, you know, I probably saw it, I guess I'm thinking, you know, very late 70s, maybe 78, 79 at a rep house in Sydney. And then I saw it again much, much later when I had moved to Italy. I was back and forth from Rome when I was living in London in the 80s and had a probably completely ill-advised Italian partner at the time. And while that was sort of evolving, I was back and forth from Rome. And then I eventually moved to Rome in 89 and was there through the end of 2002. So I saw it at least once then, and it meant something completely different because, you know, as I got to know Rome, those the aspects of Rome that are in there very much, thanks to Pasolini's involvement in the screenplay, you know, that sort of the Romanaccio dialogue, which is just fantastic. And of course, I heard that all the time because it never changes. Rome is always that city underneath its sophisticated veneer. And I sort of related to it in a different way. It's weird. It's a film that no matter how many times I see it, I am always surprised by the wallop of it at the end. You know, I always get caught up in it, feel so much for Cabiria. You know, it pulls you in. Masina is just a genius in that film at pulling you in with her sort of her comedy, you know, her clown aspect, her Chaplin-esque walk, the little waddle, the amazing costumes by, what was his name? Piero Gherardi, who did the designs, the production design and the costumes, you know, the way he puts her in this little chicken feather bolero. And
I was going to mention that. That's perfect, that bolero.
It's amazing, that bolero.
And the sandals with socks.
The sandals with socks is incredible. The hourglass skirt that is so dead, the black skirt with the little fringe on the bottom, the frill on the bottom, and then my favorite bit is the rain hat with the hole in the back for the ponytail to come out. You know, it is just not what you expect a sex worker to look like. And I think there's so much of that stuff that is so great in the film. But she pulls you in, you know, she makes you invest so much in the character. And then you feel this awful anxiety creeping up when, you know, the past repeats itself. And she is, well, I'm not going to spoil the ending for anyone who hasn't seen it. But I mean, the ending is devastating, devastating and yet beautiful. The final shot of this movie is one of my favorite shots in any movie. It really is just a killer.
It breaks your heart and yet somehow manages to elevate you as well and make you feel things are going to be okay somehow, even though how is unclear. I mean, just to give a basic sort of précis of the plot, Kabiria is a sort of nome d'arte of a sex worker who, in the words of, as you say, the Pasolini-esque dialogue, lives the life. She's described. We see her at the very beginning.
As one of the urchins in the beginning that saves her from drowning says, "È una palamita." You know, she's one who lives the life, which was a euphemism back then for being a working girl.
Absolutely. And the euphemisms here are wafer thin because this is really an explicit film in terms of what's going on. There's nothing.
Amazingly so for 1957, right? I mean, no one was making a film about Roman sex workers.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it was, I mean, so, must have been so refreshing to, I'm thinking also of like English language audiences, must have been so refreshing to sort of get these films and just like, wow, they're just so punchy and real and on the, you know, yeah, there's all this showy aspect and there's this, but even right at the very beginning, you see her basically being dumped by her boyfriend, but like literally dumped, pushed in a river so he can steal her money. And you get her as, you know, there's a line about, oh, wait, get her before she hits the sewer, the fognatura. You know,
yes, yes.
You know, it's just like, it's just so disgusting.
I love those kids.
You know,
those kids, you know, that seem to live in nothing but shorts or swim trunks, and they're so skinny as rakes. They're climbing up the scaffolding. All of those things felt very Pasolinian to me. And, you know, I think all that stuff is so beautifully observed, everything around that. I think it's Aquileia is the area maybe between Rome and Ostia where they shot. So sort of halfway between the city and the beach, the beach kind of satellite city. You know, it's such poverty there, such humble kind of means they're living by. I mean, Kabiria's cinder block house is practically a bunker, you know? It's such an unaccommodating sort of weird brutalist structure. And when she sells the house late in the film, she sells it to people even poorer than her that look like they're on their truck loaded up with everything that they own. And they look like they've stepped out of the grapes of wrath. I mean, the other thing that really strikes me every time I see this film and that I forget is just the explicitness of its examination of the giant wealth divide. You know, you've got all the toffs of Via Veneto and all the, you know, even the high-class prostitutes that are working Via Veneto are a world apart from the women doing at the Passeggiata Archeologica, the baths of Caracalla, where Kabiria and all her cohorts are working. You know, they're just a different breed altogether. And, you know, I mean, the difference between that and the poverty of, you know, her talking about some of the girls who live under the arches at Caracalla, and she's very proud of having her own house with utilities. She has water and electricity, which obviously was not a given for people living in that part of Rome at that time, which is weird because, you know, 1957 was the economic boom was in full swing in Italy, but it's so far away from these characters, so distant from them, and nowhere more so in the scenes that I always forget, where the Good Samaritan that she meets on the road home one night with his big bag of blankets and food and things. He's going around feeding people who live in the grottos. They live in the caves underground. And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, John, but was that sequence not originally cut by the censors and then recorded later?
Exactly. It was censored after the original showing. So it was shown once, but then thereafter it was censored until the 80s or the 90s. I think it was...
Because I know when it was released in America and other countries, it was released, I think, without that sequence. Mm-hmm. And it's such a beautiful moment because you also see You'll see what happens to the sex worker in the character Bomba, who is, you know, slightly mad, living in a grotto, thrilled that the Good Samaritan has come by to give her some food or whatever, and immediately goes into this kind of reverie of boasting about, you know, I once had an apartment in Rome and another one in Ostia. Men would give me furs and jewels, and I had money and things. And Kabiria says, you know, she's not wrong. I know her. She's telling the truth. She was beautiful. She was sought after. And, you know, now she is this kind of woman who is really falling apart physically, mentally. And, you know, I found all that stuff heartbreaking. I also think it's just great that the guy playing the Good Samaritan is Fellini's editor on Cabiria, La Strada, La Dolce Vita, and 8.5.
Oh, I didn't know that. Good knowledge. Yeah. I did not know that. That's interesting.
Leo Catozzo. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Wow. I love that.
Great bit of casting.
Yeah, because he's so convincing. He's so, yeah, I actually was thinking, oh, he must be sort of a volunteer from the area, and they've just used him because he's such a gentle voice and so non-judgmental of Kabiria and the people he helps.
Yeah, Fellini kind of was used to working with him, and he always talked about how collegial the atmosphere was on his shoots and post-production, all of that. You know, he even sort of used words like festoso, you know, festive. And he, I think, like to maintain a very friendly working atmosphere. You know, Flaiano and Pinelli, his regular script collaborators, always talked about it as well. But I think was not always the case with every Italian director. So, you know, maybe just got chummy with this editor, loved the sound of his voice and somehow identified him. I mean, you know, every time I hear an interview where Fellini talked about his casting process, it's always so fascinating that he would write the character a certain way and then, you know, start to see people coming in for auditions and just see a face that was nothing like the one he had written, or a body type that was nothing like the one he had written, and think, no, wait, I can imagine this person in that role. So would completely rethink it on the fly. Just great stuff.
And I love that cave scene that you talked about as well, because of it reminded me of Roberto Rossellini's Paisan. There's a similar scene of absolute poverty in Napoli with a black GI. But as you say, this is 10 years have passed, and you would think that things had changed. I mean, the economic boom is, those divisions exist, and the economic boom is to some extent touching because like one of the prostitutes has her own fiat, and they're all shouting about.
And wait, 1957 was the year the Fiat 500 came out. I think it is a Fiat 500,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely it is, yeah.
Very cool. I mean, it was very cool to see the new version of the Fiat 500 in the new Mission Impossible film. I just, those cars are such a part of Italy, and I love that a version of them still exists. There's these weird little matchbox cars on, you know, they're like toys. And of course, Italy is still world famous, worst country in the world for parking. So you know, a tiny little toy car is the best thing you can have.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I love the way she gets in the car. The working girl who's I think maybe one of the only ones who's actually got a pimp. There's a pimp who's trying to recruit Kabiria.
Called Hamlet, Amleto.
That's so good, isn't it? That's so good. Yeah. I love it when they all go to church and the guy turns around
and he takes his uncle the women are the working girls are all kind of scoffing at the idea of the uncle getting any kind of redemption it's the sanctuary of the Our Lady of Divine Love, right? Divino Amore. I love that they very rudely, in a way you would never get around with to now, call him Erzoppo, you know, the cripple. But it's so politically incorrect now, but I don't think he has a name. But the uncle, who they scoff at the idea of this person who made his money selling cocaine and pimping women, it could possibly be sort of touched by the grace of Mary, of the Madonna. And that scene is so great. It's so Fellini too, that, you know, you've got this high religiosity of, you know, people going, hoping for a cure to this shrine. And at the same time, it's pure spectacle, you know, from the lights in the church. There's a sort of a light that looks like it should be at a music hall, at a variety show, that is sort of Viva la Madonna or Viva la Maria or something in lights. And it's just so theatrical and kitschy and fantastic and pure Fellini. You know, I just think he was trying out ideas here. Well, you know, as I said before, like keeping a foot in neorealism. And all that stuff with Grotto, with the cave dwellers, is pure neorealism. You know, it's so linked to what Rossellini and other filmmakers were doing back then. And yet there are little touches of Fellini, like the, you know, the La Bomba, the former prostitute who is living underground, you know, her extravagance, her, the glory that she sort of still draws from her past is so Fellini as well. I mean, I love the way it sort of crosses all those boundaries, this film.
And she's kind of like a warning to Cabiria. She's like a future Cabiria, and also a key maybe to Cabiria's own character, that there's this sort of self-protecting exuberance to her and you know, a certain lack of self-awareness that you just need to defend yourself in that situation. She can't throughout the film, she doesn't, you admire her for not reacting to how people are treating her, and then every now and again she just gets it. She suddenly sees someone's face when she's dancing in the nightclub with the famous actor. And she's enjoying herself.
In the nightclub.
Oh, Mambo!
And when she just like, she, first of all, she's sort of somewhat decorous with the dance. And then she's just like, eh, what the fuck? Sorry, can I swear on this?
Yeah, go ahead, man. Go ahead.
She's just like into it and doing her Mambo. And, you know, Amadeo Nazzari, who I love that he's playing, you know, such a disguised version of himself, you know, the Italian Errol Flynn playing Alberto Lazzari. It was like, it could not be closer to his own name.
The spoonerism, practically.
Practically asleep on the dance floor while she just goes into crazy mode. And who cares about the withering looks she's getting from everybody else in the club, the staff and the other patrons. I mean, she just rises above it. I mean, I have to say, I love the belligerence and the feistiness of this character. I love that she is so free-spirited and so able to find joy and just, you know, on the street, dancing, you know, doing her little dance steps randomly. Everything about her physicality just gives me Charlie Chaplin. But I think that, you know, she does have her defense. She does have that sort of way of not acknowledging, but I think it's when her mask comes down and she does reveal the yearning that's underneath all that, that the film is at its most poignant. You know, and that happens, of course, in the sanctuary scene where she is, you know, she turns up like she's along for the ride with Amleto and his uncle on crutches and the other women. And she's really just along for the ride. She's sort of shrugging at it. You get this feeling she's kind of left aside her Catholic upbringing. And yet when she's very respectful, she puts the scarf over her head on the way into the church. She, takes a candle, and by the time she lights that candle, you know, she's asked Wanda, the fabulous Wanda, who I would love to talk about some more, but she's asked her, how does the act of contrition go again? You know, she's forgotten all of that past, and it all comes back when she lights the candle, and suddenly she is this desperate woman in tears pleading to the Madonna, you help me to change my life. I mean, I find that scene just completely heartbreaking. And those moments where she reveals the self that she's hiding underneath this belligerent, warmongering facade, where she's ready to pick a fight with anyone, is just heartbreaking. I do also love the other woman that she fights with, the other version of a Bomba who is sort of on the way there, the mad woman with this sort of Louise Brooks, the Pandora kind of
the grand dame, as she self-identifies.
Yes, io sono la grande dama. I love her constant abuse that she's hurling at the other women.
Arrest them all! The cops turn. I'm not running. Arrest them all!
Fantastic. That stuff is just hilarious. And, you know, of course, it takes somebody like Fellini to find the hilarity in something like that. You know, he really does manage to give you this this sort of the sublime and the squalor of it all in one hit.
And yet he's never laughing at them. There's never a sense of like, this is a parade of grotesques that we are looking down on. You always feel like, I wouldn't mind spending some time with these people. They're kind of fun. They're kind of, you know, there's misery and all the rest of it, but they're also complicated people. There's more than one side to them.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think that it's interesting that even though Cabiria is constantly rebuffing the friendship of Wanda, that is the only pure relationship in her life, that friendship that endures no matter how badly she treats her, how many times she loses her temper with her, how frequently she dismisses every very, very keen and incisive observation that Wanda usually makes, that friendship endures. And I find their parting at the end of the film very, very moving. And that actress who I did not know from other films, Franca Marzi, I think her name is. It was interesting. I saw an interview that, again, Piero Gherardi, the designer, talked about how she was actually quite a slender compared to how she appears in the film. You know, she's this statuesque, solid woman who just physically, when she's walking along next to teeny tiny little Giulietta Masina, their physicality together is hilarious, just the sight of them. But, you know, he talked about padding out her ass. She has a big padded bum and padded breasts. And he used some kind of bra filled with water. This is way before the water bra or the Wonder Bra or any of those inventions came along. And every morning on the shoot, they had to refill the bra with water and make sure there were no leaks and things so that Wanda could have this fantastic physical presence. And I love that she's so elegant. You know, even when she's wandering around the town, she's in these kind of long beaded dresses and the heels and things. She's walking on these unpaved gravel roads in heels. And you just say, yeah, she's absolute class.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. There's a concept that I always come back to. I think it's a really useful critical idea, the idea of romantic irony, where you can laugh at something, but also the thing that you're laughing at survives, you know?
Yes.
You know, Mozart's love operettas, you know, you everybody's mixed up and is singing to the wrong people, and they're singing to people they don't think they're in love with but they're actually in love with, and husbands singing to their adulterous lovers who turn out to be their wives in disguise, but and yet the love survives. And I found myself thinking about romantic irony as I rewatched this movie and thought, yeah, the as you said, there's the friendship is tried and tried and tried, but it's real and it's there. These people have real struggles and you're laughing at them, but there's resilience and there's survival.
I think resilience is the key word, particularly about Kabiria. I mean, the resilience is there in that final shot, which okay, let's spoil it. It's a film from 1957. If you haven't seen it by this point, you know, so she has lost everything in the cruelest, most humiliating, devastating way possible. She's begged this person who's betrayed her to kill her, to toss her off the cliff, which was obviously his original intention before he had a crisis of conscience and got nervous.
But still took the money.
Yeah, still took the money. It took everything she had. And, you know, she's left with nothing at the end. But she falls in with this group of revelers, this young crowd partying, dancing, singing along the street. And a young woman who could be her at a younger age says, you know, buonasera or whatever. And the Nino Rota music, which has been absent for such a long stretch of the film, comes back via the musicians playing on the street. And you get Kabiria just sort of wandering in a daze in the middle of these revelers and with her eyeliner, which has run into a perfect black tear on her face. It looks like a tattoo of a tear. And the way she allows her joy to infect her in that final scene is to me so beautiful. It allows her some hope. It allows her some sense of life going on. You get the feeling this woman is not defeated. She will never be completely defeated. She will always have these reserves to draw on. You know, she has this innocence, which is invulnerable, as jaded as she becomes, as many times as she is abused, disappointed, betrayed, you know, that innocence survives. And I do think, you know, people said often about Fellini that he loved all of his characters, even the reprobates, even the you know, the complete contemptible people. He loved all of them equally. And I think that's nowhere more so than the characters he wrote for Giulietta Masina, you know, and the two, you know, if you talk about the early ones, Gelsomina in La Strada and Kabiria are kind of sisters in a way, except that Gelsomina's purity and innocence are right there on the surface. Kabiria hides hers underneath the shield, this jaded, angry shield. Well, not angry, maybe, but belligerent. She's feisty. She's pugnacious, and that I think becomes her protection.
And I think that tear as well is, I mean, I think it's a theme that runs through the film of her also being a performer. You know, we have her dancing, we have her on the stage when she's hypnotized, and then this tear is like the pagliaccio, the clown, the crying clown.
Yeah. And of course, we all know Fellini's love of the circus. You know, he had said many times that if he wasn't a filmmaker, he would have been a circus. He would have run a circus. And, you know, he loves that atmosphere, that, and it creeps into so many of his films in different ways. It creeps into the Nino Rota scores, which could be sort of circus tunes almost sometimes. And I think that, you know, Giulietta Masina as the sad clown is just a classic Fellini creation. And she, gosh, I mean, that performance in this film, it floors me every time. I mean, I find it just beautiful and funny and devastating. And I think that she had this ability to touch people. And I mean, I love I don't know whether it's apocryphal or not, but the story of her being robbed in Rome when some kids shoved her and grabbed her bag and then returned it later with a note saying, "Ci scusi, Gelsomina," you know, "We're sorry, Gelsomina," using her name from La Strada. I remember when I was living in Rome, I used to co-host sometimes the Rai Radio 3 show, Hollywood Party. And we had for the opening of Central Station, we had Walter Salles and Fernanda Montenegro on. And Central Station is in so many ways a kind of homage to Kabiria. There's so many parallels in the film, but nowhere more so than the Fernanda Montenegro character. And, you know, I said during the show while we were recording in the studio to Fernanda Montenegro, I'm sure I'm not the first. I know I'm not the first person to make the comparison with Giulietta Masina, but were you thinking about that? Were you aware of that? And she burst into tears and emotional and talked about, you know, the honor of being compared in any way to Giulietta Masina, who was just like a god to her in terms of acting. And that was very moving. It was really lovely. I have to say, the years that I was in Rome, I'm 89 was sort of, I did not really, I started working for Variety in 91 when I was in Rome. I became the Rome bureau chief, and I did see Fellini around at various things. I remember seeing him once at a reception at Campidoglio at the Capitol for Martin Scorsese, and we were leaving and he was coming up the stairs with the red scarf flying and his usual, and the hat. And he said, "Già cominciato," you know, "has it already started?" And we said, "Well, it's finished." And he just muttered something about, "Oh, I'll go and get a drink anyway." So he went into the tail end of the reception. But, you know, I did see him around town. I love to walk in along Via Marghera, the street he and Masina lived in. And I did see them every now and then, either together or separately, mostly separately. And I think the marriage was what it was there. You know, he was famous for his philandering. And
They'd come to a kind of arrangement.
But I did see her. I mean, I remember seeing her once in the Feltrinelli bookshop on Via del Bambino, just around the corner from Via Marghera. And I really wanted to talk to her, but I was shyer than I am now. And I also just thought, no, she must be so used to this and being bothered all the time. So I left her alone. I also thought, you know, I probably won't be able to talk to her without just bursting into tears.
And when you think of those two performances as well, they're 1 year apart, you know.
And you know, interestingly, they both those films, the Fellini-Masina combination, both won the Oscar for what was then called the Foreign Language Oscar in 57 and 58. And Masina, of course, won Best Actress at Cannes for the film, for Kabiria. It's great stuff. It's so good.
And I mean, Fellini, the concept of the character comes originally from The White Sheik. It appears briefly as a sort of small part of The White Sheik. And of course, the White Sheik, I think, is a really interesting film because it has so many little keys to what Fellini's sort of going to go on and develop. A little bit like Kabiria does, but I always think of the Sanctuary moment as very similar to what he expands in La Dolce Vita with the sort of miracle of the child. By saying that, I don't mean in any way to sort of diminish what is in Kabiria, because I don't think it's, I think there's a certain bagginess to La Dolce Vita, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but which is the better film is very much depends on what mood you're in.
I think one of the key things is that the success of La Strada and Kabiria, particularly outside of Italy, I think was instrumental in getting him bigger budgets, and it allowed him to paint on a wider canvas and certainly to develop his sense of who he was as a filmmaker, to pull away from the neorealists and to kind of find the fantastical Fellini that sort of emerged to greater degrees as he went on. But, you know, there is a real difference in those films. But I think if you look at Kabiria particularly, there are two or three key sequences that I think are classic Fellini motifs that would be repeated in some way. And I don't mean repeated in a sense of an artist repeating himself or being repetitious, but I mean developed in other ways. And, you know, obviously Kabiria being a character, a minor character in The White Sheik, is one. But also, you know, the sanctuary scene is the blue plate, the template for blueprint. Sorry, for a East.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
For scenes that would happen in later films, but also the scene with the magician, the variety show, you know, is such a great Fellini scene that, and so cruel that she is there in this audience full of rowdy men. She's hypnotized, and while she's hypnotized on stage, she completely regresses back to the 18-year-old girl with the long dark hair, going to mass every Sunday with her mother. She's still called Maria at that stage, which is, could not get a holier name. And she reveals the yearning for romance, you know, for security, love, comfort, all those things that she doesn't have. And she is loath to reveal those when she is out and about and being herself. You know, she's sort of constantly saying, you know, oh, I don't need anything. I have my own house. I have the utilities. I have everything I want. You know, she refuses to have a pimp when Amleto suggests, why don't you come work with me? I'll take care of you. You know, she's like, no, I don't need anything. And yet she's just been cruelly ripped off and thrown in the river to drown. So, you know, I love that scene in the variety show with the magician, and an incredible actor. I don't remember his name. Aldo Silvani is his name. But that face is such a Fellini-esque face, kind of grotesque. There's a moment when he goes through with the hypnosis with her. He gets her to the point of revealing herself and what she really wants. And you see this look come over the magician's face, this look of conscience where he thinks, oh, this needs to stop. This woman is clearly revealing something very deep and painful and real. And that moment of compassion, I think, is very Fellini. But, you know, there are the other scene that I think is quintessential Fellini, and that was the template for scenes that would develop later on, particularly with Mastroianni in 8 and a Half, is the meeting with Amadeo Nazzari's character, the movie star. You know, he's had a fight outside the Kit Kat Club of the Avenida Swanky Club. And he's had a fight with his fabulous girlfriend, Jessie, played by... I'm obsessed with this actress, with her pseudonym being Dorian Gray.
Oh, the course. Yeah, that's so good.
I mean,
and she sort of looks like Veronica Lake or sort of Jessica Rabbit. She's sort of
She's kind of somewhere between those and Anita Ekberg in La Dolce Vita. But she, you know, she's this stormy, tempestuous type who comes out, smacks him in the face, and says, "You know, you're a ham, and this relationship is terrible, and I'm constantly humiliated and whatever." While other women are checking out other women, and you know that stormy sequence that leads to him picking up Kabiria. And, you know, almost indifferently get in the car. And, you know, she goes with him to the Piccadilly Club, then to his amazing house, you know, this incredible villa, which is such luxury, such opulence that she's never seen. And I love that there are a couple of moments in that I love, not just the interaction with him, where you see this, you see Massina's face just change from absolute awe and disbelief. First of all, somewhat suspicious. Then she's kind of just thrilled to be there. Then suddenly the tears come and she's like, well, no one's ever going to believe me. And then she ends up locked in the bathroom when Jesse comes back for the evening. And but the two moments I love are when she's entering this house and she's just kind of bewildered by the scale of it all. And there's a shot of teeny tiny Giulietta Masina going up this massive staircase. And she's like encountering the third or fourth dog. And she's just in very, very Roman, it's un altro cane, another dog. It's just a great moment. And you know, she looks just so tiny and out of place, like an alien here. And then I also love the very cruel smack back to reality as she's leaving in the morning. She's sneaking out while Jesse is still asleep after she spent the entire night locked in the bathroom. And she smacks into the glass door. It's just a great moment of physical comedy, but also a slap back to cruel reality as she, you know, picks up her shabby little umbrella and waddles out of there. I mean, it's a great scene. But that, I think that moment with the Amadeo Nazzari character is also just prime Fellini that would come back in La Dolce Vita and 8 and a Half. You know, those were the real motifs that I think he kept returning to. But I have a question for you.
Sure.
You're probably more versed in classic Italian cinema than I am, but the name Kabiria, of course, borrowed from the 1914 silent epic, you know, considered to be the birth of the epic film, where Kabiria was a little girl separated from her parents during an eruption of Etna, Mount Etna, and then later abducted by pirates. I mean, do you think there's a connection there, a reason she was called Kabiria, an homage to that film?
Oh yeah, I think it's I think that there are clues to why, because she's chosen that name as her name, sort of street name. And
nome d'arte.
Exactly, nome d'arte. And when she talks to the other sex workers and she's reporting about her new boyfriend, the respectable man, the accountant, who's taken her to the cinema, and she's saying, "Oh, there, it was a first showing. It was a prima visione. So it was because there are these different cinemas in these periods where you have the grindhouses that are very cheap, and then you have expensive cinemas which show the first the premieres of the big films
and obviously she had been to movies because she at the movie star's house when the dinner comes up she picks up this lobster and says, "What's this?" You know,
I've seen it
one in a movie.
So
she's obviously seen movies, but not prima visione, as you say. And I love that the prima visione is some gladiatorial film.
Yeah, exactly. And she's also seen a film with the guy in with Vittorio Gassman, and he says, "I wasn't in that film. That's somebody else."
Yes, it's a great moment.
It's a typical great sort moment. Of you know, "Oh, I loved you in whatever," and it's not. So she says, and then she says to the other prostitutes as a sort of like to show how sophisticated this boyfriend is. And he told me that it didn't happen, that they just made it up for the cinema. And it's like, it was like a revelation to her, you know, that this was just a made up story. It wasn't like
she thought film was documentary.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so I think that she identifies with Kabiria as this separated child and this orphan like character. And she's not seen it as a film. She's seen it as a real story, a true story. And she identifies with her in that way. And it's part of her armor of self-protection. And what is so distressing about the end, because the end had this sort of prologue to the end, if you like, this run-up where she's got in this relationship with the accountant, and he seems to be a nice guy, and he's
almost a saint. I mean, clearly we should all be aware, even without ever seeing the film before, that he is too good to be true,
but right.
He's such a saint, and their dates are so courteous, and you know, he's so sweet with her and kind, and giving her chocolates and taking her to movies and things, and he always turns up with something for her, with flowers. I mean, I love the meeting at Stazione Termini.
Yes.
When the first date, when he turns up with flowers and she's still suspicious of him. And I mean, I particularly love that scene because, you know, I moved to Rome in 89. I first went there in 84, and then I started going there pretty regularly during the late 80s. And Stazione Termini, which, you know, Termini Station, the main train station in the center of Rome, has been, you know, it's had a revamp since then. But in the 80s, it looked exactly like that, packed with people, you know, watching your pockets all the time because it was rife with pickpockets. And just packed with people. And it still looked like this hub of kind of like almost grapes of wrath poverty, of people kind of just going off, you know, going off to wherever they were going in Italy. And it was so crowded, and the shops all looked the same. The storefronts, everything about it looked the same. I found that very moving to see that. When I watched it again the other night to prepare for this, I had forgotten how much of that Rome remained intact when I was living there in the 80s and into the early 90s.
Absolutely. And when she's talking to the other girls about him, she's not saying, oh, he's wonderful, he loves me, finally I'll get out of here. They're saying, and he doesn't want to do anything. He doesn't want to, you know, they've got their logic, which is entirely based on the streets. And she's like, no, I don't understand it. I don't see what's going on. So it takes ages for her to actually say, you know what, this is my chance at happiness. This is proper relationship. It's not like she does, you know, it takes ages for her to take off that armor, so that when she's finally got it off and she's finally betrayed, it's all the more, you know, it's all the more distressing because she did it. There's no way she walks into this in a foolish way, she's been gaslit in modern.
Yeah, life. It's taken a lot to get her there. But I mean, by the time she is there, she is this completely raw, unprotected soul. You know, she is absolutely the most vulnerable creature. And I find the scenes where he takes her to the restaurant, where he takes her before the long walk through the woods, where you have this sort of sinking feeling, oh God, this is going to go very badly. And, you know, gets her to the edge of a cliff, and you see his face, even in the restaurant scene, start to transform. You see his nervousness as he tells her to put the great wad of money. It's like, yeah, it's 700,000 lira or something, which was a lot back then for someone of that income bracket, especially. And you just see that come out, and you start to feel this sense of dread in the pit of your stomach that grows and grows and grows. And it's heartbreaking that it takes her so long to see it. But, you know, I love that entire sequence. It's just, it rips your heart out. And I think that was filmed at Castel Gandolfi, which used to be the papal summer residence. It's a beautiful part of Rome. And
this amazing light on the lake as well. And I think he actually comments on it. He says something like, oh, it's what a strange light. What a strange atmosphere.
I think he says something about it's magical.
That's right. Well,
they go there for the sunset, I think. But it's, you know, it is a terrible and beautiful part of the movie. It's really, really quite something.
Yeah, and to just go back briefly to the sequence in the house that you talked, I love the fact that you brought up those two points, because those are exactly the points that when I was rewatching it, I laughed my head off at the pratfall of the glass door. as cruel as the point is, it's also so
funny. I mean, her sense of physical comedy is so great.
It's amazing. It's absolutely peerless. And the fact that
she could have been a silent film actor.
Oh, without a doubt, she could have been a Keaton. She could have been a Chaplin. And yet, at the same time, she never breaks character. It's all completely in character. Even that dance she does could easily be a bit, but it isn't. Yeah. It's exactly what that character would dance like. And I love the way she has this. And I'm not sure if this is a difference in Italy and American or English sort of, or English language culture. But I know a lot of Italians who do this thing of giving a constant, my wife is definitely one of these people, who gives a constant commentary on what they're doing. Of like, oh, and I'll put the thing over there, and this is this, and oh, what have we got here, and this is, and it's just like, and she does that when she's a sort of like, he's saying, oh, let's have some food. She's like, oh, a little olive is over here, and I've got some chicken. I don't know what this is, and it's just like this, you create a verbal atmosphere around you, a director's commentary of your own film, and it's hilarious. Just so reactive to the world, you know.
My favorite moment like that is also when she sees the car, the Fiat. That Amleto and his beautiful blonde sex worker girlfriend, I guess, are sitting and she's suddenly, you know, certo la Fiat è sempre la Fiat, you know, Fiat is always Fiat, as if it's the grandest, most luxurious automobile in the world, even though it's this tiny matchbox. But she just has this way, as you say, of commenting about everything, of narrating her own life, which I think makes her, you know, even more vulnerable. But, you know, I love also how that she is jaded. She is protective. She has put up these walls, this shell around herself. But at the same time, she is still oblivious to the evils of the world around her and the extreme vulnerability that she is in this line of work and in this environment. I mean, I love the moment where she's still in disbelief about Giorgio, the cad at the beginning of the film, who shoves her in the river and runs off with her bag and says, what would he really try? You know, would someone really try to kill you for 40,000 lira? And Wanda, the wise and worldly Wanda, just sort of shrugs and says, they'd kill you for 5,000 lira, which is about $2 American.
Absolutely. And she, I love it when they save her as well. And they're sort of like, they save her in the most unseemly, talk about physical comedy, like shaking
her upside down.
She's dead. No, she's dead. Oh, no. Does a corpse vomit water? No, she's still alive. Look, her eyes are open. And she immediately sort of bounces up and starts kicking them and saying, I want to go home. Get off me. Yes, I'm going home. Who are you?
So ungrateful for them saving your life.
Where are my shoes?
There's some very beautiful Roman moments there. Like there's a young couple and he's very interested in running in to see what's going on. And the woman standing back says, no, paura. You know, she's afraid to see. Like it's this superstition about seeing the dead is very Italian. I felt like there's a lot of Pasolini in those moments too. You know, kids. There's a moment, one of the kids says, mamma sa che è morta. And it's this, you know, I think she's dead, you know, but said with such a deadpan kind of like, it's not the first time this little kid has seen death or experienced it, you know.
It's
a tough environment. I also just love those shots. There's something very, very beautiful about those shots where Cabiria and Wanda might be in the foreground discussing and the kids are sort of scrambling up this very skeletal scaffolding in the background. I don't know what it is. I'm assuming it's some kind of construction that looks like it's been abandoned at a certain point. And, you know, I remember that is classic Italy too, constructions that get abandoned midway because the money runs out or whatever. And so you're constantly all over the country seeing these shells of buildings that are not quite finished.
The party of cement is always in power, as they say.
Yeah. But those kids, you know, those kids around that, I mean, it's, not a very Italian reference, but they look like those beautiful Ruth Orkin photographs of kids, you know, jumping in and out of rivers and things in around New York. You know, it's beautiful, and I think those moments too, the black and white of the film is just so gorgeous. It's just sears into your eyes the whole time. These beautiful indelible images.
I think it's so layered as well, because you've got the foreground and the background and things going on, and as a whole, you know, people are talking at different levels, but you've also got like the train passing in the background that's making a noise, and I think there's a sound of an airplane going overhead, and yeah, and there's work noises going on, so there's just a sense of like this place is a sort of no man's land in the middle of all this modernity, which is, you know, things are going on around and she's stuck in the middle of this little bunker in the middle of nowhere.
It's really hard to believe that it is basically the same city as Via Veneto, all these posh nightclubs and restaurants, yeah, and people eating out in cafe style outside the restaurants on the wide sidewalk of this beautiful grand via and viale. And I think that, you know, it is inconceivable almost that level of poverty exists in not quite a stone's throw, but certainly in the same geographical radius. And everything is so vividly drawn. I think that, you know, now we talk all the time about income wealth disparity, and I think he was showing that in such an incredibly vivid way back then. It was you know, almost revolutionary, because most of the neorealism films, if not all, you know, most of them were really just showing the poverty. We didn't see much of the wealth, the juxtaposition of the wealth. And I think Fellini shows that very beautifully. But yeah, all of those scenes, I'm sort of amazed. I wonder now, if the film were made under the same circumstances, if Pasolini would have just been credited as a co-screenwriter, because everything you read about him and interviews with him, he talks about having written much of the dialogue then, because Fellini, of course, was from Emilia-Romagna, and Rimini, Flaiano and Pinelli were more gentlemanly types. And Pasolini was right in there with the shadiest aspects of Rome, with the dodgiest of characters. And so he knew that speech, he knew that dialect. And so he was writing that dialogue, helping to develop those characters. And I think all of those scenes around Cabiria's home, with those other people living in poverty, and the scenes with the pimps and the women at Caracalla are very much Pasolinian, you know, in a sense that you can see the links with Mama Roma and films. And you know, I was surprised to know that the extent to which he worked on the film, and yet he gets a credit buried way, way deep in the end credits of, you know, collaborazione alla sceneggiatura, you know, collaboration on the screenplay. But I guess, you know, by that time, Fellini and Flaiano and Pinelli were already becoming a powerhouse as artistic collaborators. So they were the forerunners. And it's worth noting also that this was a film that, as we said, risky for its time, audacious to depict that kind of milieu in a way that hadn't been really depicted so much. But, you know, it was Dino De Laurentiis, a major producer who would go on to do all kinds of stuff at every level, from absolute, you know, commercial blockbusters to tiny Italian films. I mean, I think it's interesting to see that that he produced this film, and that, you know, Fellini wasn't given more kickback, you know, other than the censorship of the caves early on.
Yeah, I wonder. I was thinking about that when his name came up on the screen, of where to put Dino De Laurentiis. He's sort of like a unique Italian figure, because he's not really, you know, maybe a Sam Spiegel or someone, but he's yeah, you know, there's a bit of Roger Corman in him, and there's a bit of both the Roger Corman who did American International Pictures and the one who imported Bergman films into drive-ins, you know. Yeah, there's this mixture of sort of genre film and Flash Gordon, and yet also he produces David Lynch films and gets his gets him financing when nobody would touch him after Dune. You know, he's got a real influence, I think. I mean, I know there was a documentary, I think his daughter has been instrumental in sort of burnishing his reputation, but right, the early part of his career, I think, hasn't been as credited as I think he should be.
I mean, he was certainly an interesting character, and very different from the very gentlemanly kind of Italian producer that was the norm, like, you know, Franco Cristaldi. De Laurentiis was, the little that I knew of him in terms of encounters, where it was, you know, very much a raconteur, very lively, and you know, tons of stories and would pour out of him. And, you know, we forget that, you know, he did. How many producers do a film like Knights of Cabiria and then, you know, end up doing, you know, a King Kong remake that almost killed Jessica Lange's career? Did he not do what the very, very poorly received Silence of the Lambs sequel, Hannibal? I think that was...
Or did he do Red Dragon? He definitely did one of those.
I hope I'm not misremembering, but I think I definitely remember going to a press conference in the Uffizi, beautiful, Italian setting, the Florence
Museum. That will have been Hannibal then, because that was, they filmed there as well.
And I'm pretty sure that was Dino that was, you know, he had a little one-on-one. I can't remember if that was for the radio show or for Variety where I was writing at the time. But yeah, I'm pretty sure that was him, unless my memory is playing tricks on me. I mean, it's confusing because there was Luigi De Laurentiis and there's Aurelio, and there was a daughter who ended up producing as well. So there were a lot of De Laurentiis around.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, where do you think? I mean, I with this film, I feel that Fellini does go off and do really interesting things. And I'm a big fan of Amarcord. I'm a big fan of Eight and a Half and La Dolce Vita.
Amarcord is my favorite of the Fellini films where he really became Fellini. And I think that's probably not a controversial opinion. I think it's the favorite of a lot of people.
Yeah, it's sort of got loads of Vitelloni in it, hasn't it? The guy with a motorbike who just drives through the village at high speed all the time, shouting news occasionally.
Yeah, I love the full circle sense of that, you know, from his origins in Rimini, where he started as a cartoonist and caricaturist, you know, sketching people on the beach, vacationers on the beach at Rimini. And then, you know, he was doing for the movie theaters there. It was, you know, before there was great poster art and marketing materials available. So he was doing sketches of the movie stars that would sit in the, you know, where the lobby cards would be in the movie theaters in Rimini, you know, all those fascinating early elements of his career where he sort of learned how to observe people and draw people. And, you know, you could say that his characters always had that caricature look about them. And that started there. And I do love the full circle aspect of going from Vitelloni and the early films back there to Amarcord. There's something very moving about that film and all its exuberance and everything. It's just him going back to his origins. Whereas Rome, you know, his second home was a city that I think he always observed somewhat as an outsider. You know, I don't think he was certainly never as Roman as Pasolini was, you know, who was just entrenched in him in every way. Whereas Fellini was observing in his wily kind of circus master way.
Yeah, more a student of Rome than a sort of inhabitant, really. Yeah. Well, listen, this has been a great conversation. I've really enjoyed talking to you about Knights of Cabiria. Is there any other, like, maybe a recommendation you could give our listeners for an Italian film that they might not know just any random sort of, some maybe even something you've seen quite recently? Because I always feel that we look at these golden ages of Italian movies, and rightly so, and it's nice to sort of point people towards something maybe a bit more recent that has been done.
I don't know about a bit more recent. I will say the breakup from that Italian partner was so unpleasant. I mean, we're friends again now. Weirdly, like 25 years later, we're actually friends again.
Long distance.
But back then it was unpleasant. And it was my sort of ushering into the millennium where the millennium, you know, it was 2000 when it happened. And I had I was so over it by the time I left Italy after 13 years in Rome that I had this almost physical rejection of Italian film. I had reviewed so much Italian cinema. I'd written about it extensively. So I kind of had a rejection of it. And now when I'm at film festivals like Venice or Cannes and there are new Italian films, I tend to be very sparing about the ones I agree to take on. And no film drove me insane with annoyance to the degree this year of Nanni Moretti's film, which was in Cannes, A Brighter Tomorrow. I mean, it was so self-indulgent, navel-gazing in a way that Moretti has always been to some extent, but he has been in more insightful, amusing ways. This way was just pure self-indulgent about being Nanni Moretti, being the most fantastic, interesting thing you could have. And it was actually dull as fuck. But and just annoying and glib and facetious in all kinds of ways. But and so I don't know about recent films. I mean, I really thought that the Paolo Sorrentino's film La Mano di Dio, Hand of God, was underrated. I think that's a very you know, Sorrentino has always been accused of lifting from Fellini, nowhere more so than The Great Beauty. But, and this film does so as well, but I thought there was a real sincerity to it and a sense of the personal that's not often there in Sorrentino's films. You know, it's easy to see, just it's on Netflix anywhere in the world. So it's so easy to see. And I think I also like that film a lot because it's the 80s. I was in Italy for the tail end of the 80s. And, you know, the whole excitement built around Maradona joining the Napoli football team is so Italian. And, you know, I think there's some fantastic stuff in that film. In terms of older films, I love all of the De Sica comedies with Sophia Loren and Marcello Mastroianni, and De Sica as an actor as well. But one favorite of mine, a Commedia all'Italiana, which I think never gets the love that it should, is Risate di Gioia, Monicelli's film. I think in English it's called, it literally would translate as Laughter of Joy, and Joy is the name of the character. But I think it has another title. I can't remember what it was, but a Monicelli film with Anna Magnani in a comedy role. And, you know, Anna Magnani we think of as dramatic fireworks, but she is priceless in comedy. She is so great. And she's playing an extra at Cinecittà. She makes her living appearing in crowd scenes at Cinecittà in biblical epics and things. So that in itself I thought was fantastic and hilarious. And she is swindled and you know, ends up in prison. She has this disastrous New Year's Eve where she's out with Ben Gazzara, you know, who, of course, we know from his American films, but one of his rare Italian films. Very, very funny and so much great stuff about the church. In that. I mean, you know, it revolves around sacred necklaces that are stolen off a Madonna statue in a church. And it is a great film. I find it hilarious. And Magnani's performance in it is one of my favorites. So I would say that is a film. You know, everybody knows Big Deal on Madonna Street and the classic Monicelli comedies. But Risate di Gioia is one of my favorites.
Absolutely. I've not seen that. I'm gonna put that on my watch list straight away. I just recently watched Boccaccio 70. Boccaccio 70. And that's Fellini, Monicelli, De Sica and Visconti. So I mean
those portmanteau films are incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, they're very uneven. Some are better than others, and some episodes are better than others. But occasionally you will get one that's a complete gem. There's one I can't remember what it's called, and I can't even remember who directed the segment. But it's basically a taxi ride in which Anna Magnani has an argument with the cab driver about whether her dog, which she's taking in the taxi, is a lap dog or not a lap dog, because a lap dog gets in for free and the taxi driver maintains that it's bigger than a lap dog, so she has to pay extra. And she gets into this incredibly, incredibly Magnani-esque screaming match with the cab driver. And it's just the most hilarious, like 10 minutes or whatever it is, 15 minutes. It's such a great piece. I know, you know, it's Magnani in Rome just firing on all cylinders.
What more do we need?
And apparently, this was a little footnote I read somewhere that Cabiria, I think Cabiria, that originally, you know, he says it was written for Mazzina, but there's somewhere I read that Magnani was at some point considered for this film. That she read, I don't know whether this is true or not. I read it somewhere. It wasn't particularly well sourced, but somebody had said Magnani apparently read the script, read the scene with Amadeo Nazzari, and said, "Really, Federico, do you think I would let some asshole lock me in a bathroom for an entire night?" And she wasn't interested. But I don't know. I like to think that it was written for Messina and nobody else, because certainly nobody else could have played it that way. And it's the reason we still love that film today.
Exactly. I got a feeling Messina would make any script into a Messina film ultimately, because just of the she's an actress who feels like she's writing it herself. I mean, not by in any sense of artificiality, but it feels like she is. You should credit her as well with a major part of the creative process.
Yeah, there. I mean, it's interesting that Fellini talks about he had talked in interviews about how free his scripts were and how the characters are never really set in stone until he starts shooting and starts getting the actors in there. So I assumed that meant improvisation and that, but apparently not, you know, apparently it was all like going back and working with the writers again and tweaking characters. Because, you know, when Messina is asked the same question, whether there is improvisation in Gelsomina or Cabiria, she is very deferential and says, no, it all comes from Federico. She's always deferential to him being this sort of 360 degree artist, and all of the vision is his, even though a lot of the comedy obviously comes from her.
I was interviewing George Stevens Jr. about the AFI recently, and he told me that Fellini came to talk to them as a guest sort of speaker, and that inaugural class in 1969, they were all very much into the idea of the 60s and freedom and improvisation, and they saw Fellini as one of their own. This is a guy who just throws a circus up and films it, and it's amazing. Right. And so they asked him this question, how much is improvisation important to your process? And he went, not at all. I prepare everything. Everything is written. Everything is worked out in advance. And then if something happens, that's great. But I'm not, you know, it's time is too expensive for me to be trying to work it out as I'm, you know. And it was fun because George Stevens Jr., from his father, comes from the old school. And so he was saying, it was one we won. You know, we won that argument. Yes, you need to learn how to make a film. You can't just turn up with a camera. You know?
Discipline, budget, stick to the plan, all of that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, listen, David, it's been an absolute joy talking to you. And
same for me, John. I really, really had a nice time. Thank you.
Brilliant. Take care, man.
See you in Venice.
Arrivederci ragazzi, ci vediamo in un prossimo film.
Lo speriamo.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.